Today we're continuing an interview with Reverend Kevin Annett, former minister of the United Church in Port Alberni, B.C. Kevin has been very active in exposing information of the historical atrocities committed against First Nations children in the church-run residential schools and the ongoing cover-ups on the part of the church, the government, and certain Native leaders around these issues. In this interview, he talks also about the ongoing criminal activities against Native communities that continue today, and particularly the allegations of pedophile rings operating within the Vancouver Club, an elite social organization whose members include influential businessmen, politicians, lawyers, and judges in British Columbia. And now, that interview with Reverend Kevin Annett on CKLN.
In the same article, it admits that in 1960, to quote the article, the church in Ottawa were informed of widespread sexual abuse at the schools, but Ottawa responded with a directive to keep the incidents out of the media. Unquote. So in as early as 1960, the United Church and government were covering up abuses, including allegations of killings at these schools. But I found in the records at UBC evidence as far back as 1921 that showed the same thing going on. Basically, Indian agents saying, you know, we know the children are dying in these schools, but it involves the church, so we're going to not follow up on these incidents. To give you an example of that, I've got a letter here from an Indian agent who was responsible for the West Coast schools. His name was Harry Gallaud, and he actually started out as an Anglican church missionary, and then he went into the government, quite a common pattern. And in 1903, he wrote to the Indian Affairs Superintendent and about the health conditions in these schools. And he writes, quote, "Few of the children will survive anyway. They are an impediment to the securing of local land by our people. Simple humanity requires the removal of the Indians who remain into the residential schools so that the ones who can be civilized can be won away from the corrupting influences of their parents and elders. This will undoubtedly mean that many of the children will die from the conditions in the schools, particularly the appalling incidents of tuberculosis. But such is in keeping with the existing practices, and I see no disadvantage to this department to continue in this vein." Unquote. That's a letter from January 12, 1903, to Ottawa. And he's basically saying, we know that it's a death sentence to send these children to these schools, but we're going to do it anyway, because otherwise the kids are going to stay on their land, and we need that land to, you know, for white settlement. And it's one of the things we've submitted to the United Nations to show that the genocide in Canada was intentional. It wasn't an accident. Mm-hmm. There was a deliberate intent to kill children in these schools. Proof of that is in the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People that Ottawa conducted over a number of years. They admit in that report, which is in the hundreds of pages, they admit that the mortality rate in residential schools was over 40% on average. Hmm. Now, you know, we're talking, they admit about 125,000 students went through the schools. We're talking then at least 50,000 Native children who died in these schools. That doesn't happen accidentally. It happens because there's a whole climate there of very unhealthy, disease-ridden schools that the children are being forced into under law, filled with brutalizers and pedophiles, and who are protected by law. So naturally, you're going to have a lot of children dying and a lot of cover-up going on, which is, in fact, what's happened.
Now, that figure of 125,000 children that went through the school system, that was during the entire period that these residential schools had been run?
That's right, yeah. And, in fact, that's lower because not all the kids were put on record. Often I found in the West Coast schools that they kept very poor records, and in fact, the RCMP would go into a whole area and do what they call a sweep. They would clear out the entire village of any children and put them in the schools. And I found a letter once from the Housed principal, a guy called John Wood, in the 1930s, who said that there were a lot more children in the school than he had record for, that children were being brought in indiscriminately, including children underage. You weren't allowed to put a child under 7 in these schools, but he had said there were 3- and 4-year-olds in these schools. So when they say 125,000, it was higher. Hmm. and as was the, you know, the death rate. What was really amazing, too, is that I found a report by a guy called Dr. Bryce, who was the head medical officer for the Ontario Health Board in 1909, and he was commissioned by the Indian Affairs Superintendent, a guy called Duncan Scott, who sent Dr. Bryce out to check out the health conditions in all the residential schools in the West, you know, on the prairies and on the West Coast. Well, Bryce wrote this scathing report, which was buried by Duncan Scott because of, you know, his worrying, in his own words, that the churches, especially the Roman Catholics, would be offended by this report. Well, the report basically said that children were being deliberately infected with tuberculosis in these schools. In fact, you know, to quote this one sentence, "I believe that conditions are being deliberately created in these schools for the spreading of infectious diseases." And he gave examples of children being locked in the same ward, healthy children being locked in the same dormitories at night with children who were dying of tuberculosis, of children being admitted into the schools who had TB, and of deaths being covered up after they happened. Well, that report by Dr. Bryce was buried, and yet at our tribunal, a couple of people from Vancouver Island described how they, in fact, in the 1930s, at two different schools, at both a Catholic and a United Church school, they were forced to sleep in dormitories with children who had TB. And so, you know, this firsthand testimony is confirming what people right within the system are saying as well, that the children were being deliberately exposed to these diseases in the schools. So, you know, no wonder so many of them died.
What do you think was the ideology of the church and the government behind this? What was their intent?
Oh, well, I mean, it was very clear, and it's even in black and white. It's basically the idea that these people are not human. They're subhuman. Some of them can be saved. Some of them can be civilized. But the rest are basically fair game to do anything we want to them. I remember an example, one of Harriet Nahani, who was one of the witnesses, who saw a United Church minister kick a child down a flight of stairs to her death. She described how when she was going through the schools, this would be the Alberni school in the late 40s and early 50s. She was held down regularly, you know, whenever the dentist came in, and they worked on her teeth with a painkiller. And another fellow, Dennis Tellio, in the 1960s at the Alberni School described the same thing, that, you know, the dentist would come in, would drill his teeth without giving him anything, would jab him in the gums if he moved. It was, you know, you don't do that to little children. I mean, imagine doing that to a little 6 or 7 year old child. You wouldn't do it unless he was some kind of sadist, or unless there was kind of a mentality that, well, these people aren't really like us anyway. They're different, and they're not Christians. And, you know, proof of this is I came across this thing called the Evidence Act in BC. One of my lawyer friends suggested I read it. And sure enough, in the 1960 revised version of the Evidence Act for BC, it describes Indian people as uncivilized because they have no knowledge of God. And what's really remarkable about that is that isn't a Christian church speaking. That's the law of the land. That's the law which determines whether or not people can give testimony in court. And it describes Indian people, I've got the quote right here, as, quote, uncivilized persons bereft of a knowledge of God or of the life hereafter. So if the law of the land is saying these people are not civilized, they're not human, and that's in 1960, then you can imagine the climate that existed before then, which basically legitimated everything. Time and again, you'd hear comments from witnesses at our tribunal that said anything was okay if it killed Indians. I think it was open season on people up here, but in the Canadian context, that's I guess that maybe it's the, you know, the way that the British ran their empire was more with this kind of benign moralism attached to it, and you couldn't openly say we want to kill Indians. It would be couched in different language. There was all sorts of catchphrases used. Just the same way that in the media now you hear this term abuse in reference to the residential schools. I mean, abuse can be anything from harsh language up, and it doesn't really describe what went on in these schools at all. The language is used to hide the genocide, And that's, in fact, been going on for a long time in Canada.
Can you talk about what it would have been like for a child to have been a student of these residential schools? What would it?
Oh, very well. I've got a very good description of that. They basically, I remember when Harriet Nahani first told me about what happened to her, she was one day playing on the beach at her village near Port Renfrew on the west coast, and this RCMP gunboat showed up. A minister and some Mounties got off the boat and began running around grabbing kids, literally just sticking them on this boat without talking to the parents, without giving the kids a chance to say even goodbye. And they just kidnapped these children from the village. They traveled in the hull of this boat like it was a slave ship, and the next day they arrived in Port Alberni. They weren't given any food or water. 300 of them arrive at the same time at the Alberni Residential School. The first thing that happens to them is they're lined up and their heads are shaved, and they have this DDT powder spread all over them. Harriet says the first night that she was there, she heard this terrible scream, and the next day somebody said that, you know, a young child had been beaten to death by one of the matrons. So these kids would be surrounded by violence and death all the time. They were made to eat food which was, Harriet described maggots crawling in the first meal she ever had there. And what's interesting, too, is that there was a group of students who were cultivated as collaborators. They're often called the enforcers by people who lived through that. Harriet calls them that. And these were Native kids who were rewarded for informing on their fellow students. One of the ways they were rewarded was they were given privileges. They got to go to school. Harriet and the others who spoke their language or tried to hold on to their traditions, they were punished by becoming the manual slaves, if you like, at the school. They scrubbed the walls and worked in the kitchen, and they didn't get to go to school, but the informants did. And it's interesting because those kids today are the educated class within the Aboriginal society. They're the ones who run the band councils and the tribal councils. They're the ones who you often see on TV speaking on behalf of all the Native people about the residential schools, when in fact their history is one of collaboration. And in fact, we found that some of these Native leaders are in fact themselves implicated in the abuse of their fellow students and even in some deaths. So that's why the ironic thing is that today some of the people who have opposed what we're doing the most are in fact the Native leaders themselves, because there's that whole tradition of collaboration and complicity, their own complicity in the terrible things that went on in the schools.
It seems like the schools have managed to mold them as state agents.
Yes,
in later
exactly.
life.
Exactly. The schools were absolutely successful. That was one of their purposes, was to assimilate a minority and dispose of the rest. And, you know, when you go downtown Vancouver or any major city in Canada and you look at the condition of most Aboriginal people, you know that succeeded. Most people, they're being gradually wiped out by the traditional killers of Native people, you know, alcoholism, violence, drug addiction, poverty, all that stuff is wiping people out. And that's the way it seems from on the ground. I mean, you know, there's a very different perception if you're in church circles or, you know, working with the official Native leaders who live in conditions that are comparable to the middle class in Canada, but they're completely cut off from their own people.
I've heard accounts of former students of the residential schools of an environment of constant humiliation, constant punishment, and coupled with at night the priests sexually abusing these kids. Can you talk about these accounts, and how many accounts have you heard similar to this?
Well, a lot. I've heard lots over the last 5 or 6 years, but at the tribunal where we kind of systematically documented these offenses, that was definitely the norm. I mean, in fact, Harriet and others have claimed that the Alberni school was special because it operated as kind of a farm for pedophiles. There was a number of dignitaries who would regularly show up. These would be people, you know, politicians, church leaders, others, who would acquire children through the school. So it wasn't just abuse happening within the school, but there was a pedophile network operating out of these schools. And that pedophile network is continuing today in BC. We've had reports actually from three different sources that the Native reserves, including the Squamish Reserve right here in Vancouver, has provided children at the Vancouver Club, which is kind of the main establishment club in Vancouver where the lawyers and the judges and the politicians, the bigwigs, tend to hang out. And, in fact, in every case, it turns out that the go-between, the people providing these children, have been Native leaders themselves. Mm. So, I mean, it all makes sense if you understand what happened in the schools, how, you know, when you're abused at that young age, it turns you into an abuser often yourself. Right. And you have an interest in keeping this stuff quiet. I mean, frankly, a number of the death threats have been coming from within the Native leadership themselves, because they are very scared that their own history and their own complicity in this stuff is going to come out when we start really opening the lid on what went on in the schools, the residential schools.
I also understand that at the residential schools, there was a concerted effort to split up Native children that belonged to the same culture and shared the same language, and even split up family members. What do you think was behind that?
Well, it was part of the way of not only deculturalizing people, but brutalizing. I guess the word is traumatizing people so badly that they'll do whatever you want. You know, we see this all over the world. I remember when I went to Mexico in the 80s and I was talking to Guatemalan refugees, the same thing occurred there when they described how the Guatemalan army would go around and traumatize people with tortures and that kind of thing because they wanted their land, they wanted the oil and the nickel and the other stuff on the Mayan land. Well, the same thing happened up here. I mean, there was no difference at all what happened. And what we found was that, for example, when children were brought into the schools, they were, it was almost like the ones like Harriet who were most rooted in their own traditions, they were targeted right away. Harriet was hidden for 5 years by her family, and she wasn't actually grabbed by the Mounties until she was 10. And they knew that she had that language and those traditions in her, and she was the daughter of a chief. So the children tend to look to her all the time. When they were given an order, they would look at Harriet to see if they should obey it. Well, Harriet was targeted, and literally every night for 5 years, Principal Caldwell and a man called Arthur Plint, who's in jail now, they took her into the infirmary, and they raped her from age 10 to age 15. And Caldwell, the United Church minister there, was the one that Harriet saw kick a little girl down a flight of stairs. He also, according to another witness, murdered a boy at the Ahouset School, beat him to death for taking a prune out of a jar. Now, Caldwell himself had relatives in my congregation. His daughter was in my group, my church, and I mean, you don't have to look too far to see one of the reasons I was fired, but what it also indicated when people told me those stories was how people had to be divided so that they could be either assimilated or destroyed outright.
Do you have any idea how many schools were run over throughout Canada? How many schools were running?
According to the official records, there was over 100. About, I think I saw a figure of 110. This would be, there weren't just residential schools, but day schools operated by the mainline churches.
And what would the difference be there?
The difference is that day schools, the kids just came for the day like a normal school. Uh-huh. The churches were really against that, and they fought all along to set up these residential schools, even when the government wanted to close them, because they said that, well, the only way, because of the nomadic habits of Native children, especially here on the coast during fishing season and that, they wanted the kids in the school all year round because they wanted to separate them from their land, from their culture, from the language, and having them under control 100% of the time was the way to do it. So it was really a church operation. I mean, they were the ones continually pressuring the government to maintain these schools.
Hmm. And were there allegations and accounts of similar types of abuses going on at these day schools as well?
Well, we haven't heard a lot about the day schools. I remember, for example, there was a woman from Bella Bella who said that her mother went to the Ahouset Day School and that she was used in penicillin vaccine experiments where children were basically farmed out to a number of pharmaceutical companies like Bayer, to be used for testing on various experimental drugs, including in the 1930s, the penicillin vaccines. So that kind of thing did go on in the schools as well, but we've got more scanty kind of information about that.
It seems that these accounts of abuse, torture, and humiliation that went on at these schools was it happened at almost all of the residential schools. Have you heard of any residential schools that that kind of practice didn't go on?
No, I haven't. It was the norm. It wasn't that. If you assume, like the church is trying to show, that these were kind of aberrations, that these were individual nutcases, then logically it would follow that it would happen in some schools and not others. But every school that I've investigated in BC, this would be 9 of 14, it all happened. The same kinds of things happened, regardless of whether it was Catholic, Anglican, or United Church. The same kind of tortures and other atrocities were going on. So, you know, it's kind of like saying, well, was there a Nazi concentration camp where people weren't being brutalized? Of course not, because there was an underlying aim there. There was a purpose. And the same kind of genocidal purpose was at work in the residential schools.
And why do you think what in your opinion was driving that? From it sounds like the church was you'd mentioned the church was pressuring the government to run these schools.
Yeah.
Where do you think the underlying drive was to in this this institutionalization of genocide?
Where the motive was coming from?
Yeah. Do you believe that originated within the church itself?
Well, it was a shared ideology. You can't really make a distinction between church and state. Mm. Both of them believed that, you know, Anglo-Saxon Christian culture was superior. And in fact, it had to be that other cultures had to be eradicated. I think that's inherent within the Christian missionary impulse, was that idea that the whole world had to be not only converted to our religion, but our culture. And you know, you find this phrase popping up all the time in the missionary literature, making the world England. Well, I mean, literally, they wanted to do that. They wanted to make everyone carbon copies. In theory, they wanted to make everybody carbon copies of themselves. In practice, what that meant was taking a certain minority of people who could be assimilated and disposing of the rest. I mean, for example, on the West Coast here, you continually find, when you go into Native homes, this story of British sailors distributing blankets in Esquimalt, which is the naval base near Victoria. And these were, as happened all over the world, smallpox-laden blankets. And in 1865, there's a record that all the Indians in Victoria were ordered out of town. They had to go back to their homes. Well, if you want to spread an infectious disease, that's how you do it. You send the people back to their communities. And sure enough, on the West Coast, in Harriet's own village, she has the record that at that time, there was about 4,000 Didadats, they were called, her people, the Didadat Nation. There was about 4,000 in the 1860s. There were 44 in 1894 when the day school opened there. So in about 30 years, 999 out of 1,000 Didadats were wiped out. That's like well under 1% of people who survived. And you don't get that from the kind of notion that's in the establishment here in Canada, the idea that, well, this kind of happened accidentally as a consequence of us being here, and it's too bad, and we're trying to make it better now. No, it was intentional. I mean, you don't get that level of mortality unless it is intentional.
Mm-hmm. Did you come across any, historically, any examples of priests within the church opposing this policy of genocide?
There's an occasional example. I mean, for example, the Howsett principal in the 1930s wrote a number of letters which are quite amazing. They to Indian Affairs, he said that he felt that the children were dying at an alarming rate in the school because of the conditions there, because of the poor food and unheated dormitories they had to sleep in at night. And he said that unless this changed, he was going to resign. And sure enough, 3 months after that letter, he resigned. So, I mean, you did get people, you know, kind of appalled at this. In fact, at one of our forums in Vancouver last year, a woman from Ontario came out, and she said that she was a teacher in the Alberni school in the early 1960s. And she gave a story about how she tried to protect a young Indian girl who was being beaten with a table leg by one of the matrons there. And, I mean, there was blood flying everywhere, and this little kid was being killed. Well, Marion, this woman, said that she stopped the woman. In fact, she said she slugged the matron to get her to stop. And she took this bleeding child in the infirmary, and she went to John Andrews, who was the principal, and said, you know, she wanted this woman fired. Well, in fact, it was Marion who reported the incident that got fired. And the principal said to her, we couldn't fire the other woman because she plays the organ on Sundays. And he said to her, it wouldn't matter what happened to that child, even if the child died. That isn't as important as the fact that we need an organist on Sunday. Now, that's in the 1960s in the United Church School, and it shows you the kind of legitimation of this reign of terror that was going on. If you stood up against what was happening, you were fired. I mean, even the rules in the Alberni school said that nobody could challenge the authority of the principal, and you couldn't even speak to anybody outside the school about what was going on without the permission of the principal. So it was the thing to understand is that the residential schools were operated on a military basis. They were like concentration camps. They were operated on the same basis of secrecy and military control. And so it isn't surprising that a lot of the stuff didn't get out for many years. I mean, Indian people aren't going to talk about it. They're not going to trust a white person. And they can't even talk about it in their own community because a lot of their own chiefs are pedophiles themselves. They're abusers. They were the enforcers. So who do you really go to as a Native person about this stuff? I mean, it's only recently, once that, you know, this affiliate of the United Nations has come in and we've had more international exposure in this, people have felt safe enough to come forward with this, you know, the deeper atrocities. But up till now, it's small wonder that people have been, you know, threatened into silence like this.
Right. Can you tell us what effect has the residential school experience had on Native people's lives now?
Well, I mean, it's probably the single most destructive thing that happened. You know, you don't talk to... I worked downtown for a number of years, like I said, off out of First United Church. And, you know, most of the people we were working with when I was training for ministry were Native people, and every single one of them had been through a residential school, or their parents had been. And, you know, the intergenerational effects of this stuff are really severe. I mean, you know, imagine as a five-year-old child, you're put in a little dorm that's unheated, you're never hugged, you're never allowed to speak to anybody from your village, you can't speak your own language, or you get, you know, a needle stuck through your tongue, or you get beaten to death. You don't learn what it is to be a normal, loving person, and so how can you raise your own children? They've even got a thing called the residential school syndrome here among psychologists, where they talk about that, and it's destroyed an entire culture. I mean, even children who never went through the school have been incapacitated by it. And, you know, it's no accident that all the indicators right across the board show that, I mean, we're living, if you live in a Native community, you're living in a third world society. I think there was even on the front page of the Globe, they said that off-reserve Natives in B.C. rank 64th in the world. If they constituted a nation, their standard of living would be 64th. That's below Brazil. And on reserve, it's 32, I believe. But, you know, it's like all of this is like you were suggesting, proof that the residential schools worked, that they achieved their objective, which was a legitimate form of genocide.
Mm-hmm. How are Native communities trying to heal now?
Well, I really would caution you about that word heal, because that's, again, another word that's been fabricated pretty much by white society. That's not a word you hear in Native communities, ever. Not on the ground. You don't hear about people healing from this stuff because, I mean, realistically, how can you?
Right.
The healing, what I like to joke about with people is I say, what's being healed by the official residential school healing program, the only thing that's been healed there is white guilt and legal liability. Because, you know, by going through this process of so-called healing and giving money, you know, shelling out a few crumbs to people, the churches and the government are hoping they'll be spared major lawsuits. Even though, you know, I think it's 1,400 lawsuits now that are being brought against the churches and the government in Canada. But you don't hear about healing among people themselves. It's not something that's going on. I mean, I don't see it happening. I don't see any of the money that's been promised by the federal government percolating down to anybody except the elite on the Van Council, you know, the collaborators, if you like. And so we really have to be aware of that word, because it's not happening. It's pretty much a fiction in the mind of the media and the churches.
Yeah, I didn't mean in terms of response from the government, but within the native communities themselves, what are they doing to recover from this devastation?
Well, I can tell you, when I worked in Port Alberni and here in downtown Vancouver, that gives an example of on and off reserve. And there's official programs that are set up, but I mean, for example, people, women in the Alberni area, native women, used to come to me and talk about what a joke it was because some of the male elders in the Nuchelnuth Tribal Council would fly down to Arizona and go to kind of a, quote, healing conference with Hopi elders. And then they'd fly back, and a couple of $1,000 would be given to them to do that. But she said that constituted their healing program so that they could learn how to be a counselor. Hmm. And yet the irony is that, the same people themselves were often abusers in the school and were convicted of pedophilia as well among their own people. So, you see, it's easy to transplant the programs in white society into Native, but it doesn't work because... What Harry Nahaney told me once is the way we're going to heal is to get back to our own traditions, to recover the potlatching, to recover our link with the land, to recover our language. And that's what heals us as a people, not, white counselors coming in and telling us, about our mental problems. It's pretty much like what happens in the courtrooms now. The people profiting from all this are white lawyers and white social workers, not the people themselves.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what the history of the United Church has been in covering up their involvement in these residential school abuses where information has gone out in terms of the media?
Well, like I say, there's been a long history of that cover-up. I mean, they're even admitting now that in 1960 they asked the Ottawa to keep reports of the Alberni school out of the media, which they did. But, I mean, it happened on the level of individual intimidation. It happened... here's another good example. We have information that a place called the W.R. Large Memorial Hospital in Bella Bella is a United Church run hospital that was funded by the Department of Indian Affairs. And a number of women came to the tribunal who described that they were sexually sterilized in this hospital by a guy called Dr. Darby. Well, Dr. Darby was a United Church missionary and doctor on the coast there for 40 years. And he claimed to Ethel Wilson, who was one of the witnesses at our tribunal, he said to her that he was being paid by the Indian Affairs Department for every non-Christian Indian that he sterilized. So the records from that hospital, amazingly enough, were found washed up on the beach south of Bella Bella in late 1994, which is right when the residential school inquiry was opened. In fact, I was fired just 2 weeks before the RCMP officially opened their so-called task force into the residential schools. And right at that same time, the medical records from the hospital are found washed up on the beach. I mean, somebody went out and tried to get rid of this stuff and at this United Church hospital. So, this whole thing, I mean, one of the witnesses said to me once, anything you hear about the residential schools that come from the church or the Mounties or the government, don't believe because it's all a fabricated story. They've had to create this to cover the terrible things that went on. And, we had so many examples of that at the tribunal that it wasn't funny.
Hmm. Now, in November of this past year, the United Church has begun to apologize for the abuses at the residential schools. Why do you believe that they have issued these apologies now? What's forced them to do this?
Well, it was kind of funny because when I was being delisted, one of the United Church officials told me that they weren't allowed to say anything without getting the approval of their insurance company lawyers in Toronto, who are pretty much running the church, he claimed. And one of the things these lawyers tell their people is never admit wrongdoing. And for years, the church didn't do that. They basically denied it was their responsibility. They denied they did anything wrong. Then the lawsuit started, and they realized they had to do more than that. And it's basically after they've been threatened with lawsuits, the so-called apologies start to come. And an example of why that happened was, I mentioned earlier this fellow, Daryl Watts, mm-hmm. Who was one of the plaintiffs in this trial against the United Church and the federal government. And he killed himself after being badgered by the United Church lawyer on the stand. Well, it turned out that he died on October 26th, and then in November the United Church issues his apology. Well, naturally, because it turned out that they kidnapped Daryl from his parents. They never got their parents to sign a release form. And they the evidence had just come out that they were involved in a cover-up with Ottawa about these schools. So, yeah, I think at that point a lawyer is going to say, you better start apologizing. You better start sitting down and making settlements. Otherwise, this is going to blow up into a major scandal, and we have to, and here's the bottom line, I think, they have to keep the evidence out of the court record. Hmm. The way you do that is by having healing circles. You get private settlements with people so that the witnesses aren't called to court. Apparently, under the law, if you admit that you did something wrong, it never has to go to court because a person said, yeah, I did it. We can settle out of court, and then none of the evidence has to be registered or kind of recorded at all. So if you want to keep this, you know, deeper stuff out of the record, that's the way to do it. You start apologizing, make limited settlements with people out of court, and hope it'll all blow away. And I think that's the strategy of the church now.
Are there any legal cases that are currently going on against the church or the government?
Oh, there's a whole mess of them. I mean, you hear of new ones every day. People in our group, when we organized the tribunal, for the people in our group, they were all bringing individual lawsuits against the United Church. And what was interesting is as soon as they did that, their own lawyer came to them and said, you better tone down talking about killings because they're not going to give you any money unless you agree to stop talking about that stuff. So unfortunately, taking lawsuits against the church is in a way playing their game, because one of the conditions they have is kind of a gag order where stuff about the killings and the deeper stuff will not be talked about in exchange for, you know, throwing $50,000 their way. And so that's, I guess, one of the ways that the cover-up continues through the courts, you know.
Is there any groups currently not willing to play that game and to expose?
Yeah, there's. I mean, you know, you hear of other people within our group, for example, that say we're not going to go to court for that reason. We just want to continue bringing the truth out. And people in BC who are more on kind of believe in what they call the sovereignty movement, which is not recognizing the treaty process, say, look, we never signed away this land anyway, and we have no need to sit down and try to get money from these people. They're the ones in the wrong. They should get off our land. It's that simple. Hmm. So, I mean, you get all sorts of opinions within the Native community. It's like any society, right?
Mm-hmm. Now, I'd like to talk about the tribunal that happened last June. Was it June of 98?
June of last year, yeah.
Yeah. And this was sponsored by a UN, the UN or a UN affiliate?
Well, it was called the International Human Rights Association of American Minorities, mm-hmm. Or IRAM. They're what they call they have consultative status at the UN. So they can write reports for the Secretary General, and they're accepted, you know, as official reports. They're an NGO attached to the Economic and Social Council of the UN. And we invited them in and to monitor and really help sponsor this tribunal. It went on for 3 days, and about 20 Native judges from, most of them were Native judges, some white, were brought in from all over the continent and heard these testimonies. It was all videotaped, and it was supposed to be sent off to the UN Human Rights Commission. But that was sabotaged for some reason. We're still trying to figure out how and why. But it might have something to do with the amount of influence Canada has at the UN. It might have to do with the role of some of the Native leaders in that, because they don't want to be implicated themselves. I mean, we're still trying to figure that out, but it was a great opportunity for people to come forward, and they did. I mean, we had probably over 200 people coming out. When it was kind of ironic, because when the official Native organizations would hold a forum on the residential schools, they'd get maybe 30, 40 people coming out. When our group, you know, connected to the UN would hold something, we'd get hundreds. And that's because people would not want to come out to meetings sponsored by their own Native leaders, because they're too intimidated in front of these people, because they know that they're abusers themselves, or they're going to get threatened if they tell too much. But it was in front of this more neutral kind of body that people felt able to come out and speak. And we were hearing some quite amazing things. I mean, even for me, I'd never heard some of these things before.
How did the tribunal come about?
Just that. We contacted this IRAM organization, invited them to come and sponsor it. And
but you had an idea for holding this tribunal within your group in the first place?
Well, it had been talked about for a number of years. Basically, there is no non-governmental investigation into this. I mean, I joke with people all the time that for the RCMP to investigate the residential schools would have been like Richard Nixon conducting the Watergate inquiry. I mean, it's absurd. It was the Mounties were the ones who were deputized under the Indian Act to arrest children who ran away from the schools and to go out and collect them in the first place, kidnap them from their villages. And the Mounties have been, they've done such a, they've been caught in so many lies. An example of that is the, when I went public with some of these reports of murders, I got a call, several threatening phone calls from the Mounties. A guy called Paul Wilms, who was running the Residential School Task Force, and then Constable Jerry Peters. Both of them said that it was, you know, that these children died of natural causes. And I said, well, we have eyewitnesses that say otherwise. They produced this so-called death certificate for Maisie Shaw, who was the little girl kicked down the flight of stairs by Reverend Caldwell at the O'Burney School in 1946. And they, you know, the death certificate claims that she died of pneumonia. Well, we got a reporter to go over and check out this information, and the funeral home that the death certificate claimed she was handled through had never even heard of her. They didn't have a record of a Maisie Shaw. Neither did the cemetery where she was to be buried. And yet the Mounties hold this up as proof. I mean, you know, they've doctored documents. We have testimonies from people who describe how they were threatened by the Mounties not to talk about what they knew. The Mounties have never gone out and interviewed any of our people who claim to have witnessed killings or found dead bodies at the schools. You know, it's so blatant, it's really comical. If there wasn't, it would be humorous if there wasn't such terrible things involved. And it's because, you know, that all the actors in this are all linked, and there's no way they can conduct an impartial inquiry into this. And so, knowing all that, we wanted to set up an independent inquiry, and we think that kind of thing should happen right across the country, where agencies like, say, Amnesty International or UN affiliates, NGOs, Oxfam, groups like that, should really get together and, independently of any church or government funding, just look into what really went on in these schools, because we think it indicates a much, you know, deeper Holocaust that was happening and the effects of which are still going on.
Now, what were the end goals of the tribunal?
Well, the main purpose of it was pretty clear. It was to take all the evidence they'd acquired and submit it to the United Nations Human Rights Commission and ask the Mary Robinson, who's a High Commissioner for Human Rights, to determine whether a charge of complicity in genocide should be brought against the Canadian government and the churches here on the grounds that in 1952, Canada signed this UN Charter on genocide. Now, there's five things in there that are described as constituting genocide, and every single one of those things happened in the residential schools. On that basis, Canada is literally guilty of genocide, and yet no charges have ever been brought. So the purpose of the tribunal was to provide the evidence to allow that process to start. And like I say, it was derailed for some reason, but we think, you know, the need is all the more important now to get this evidence and get it out so people can begin to bring pressure to allow that to happen, you know.
Now, you mentioned that the video evidence was sabotaged somehow. What was the nature of that?
Well, I mean, some very odd things began to happen at the tribunal. Some of the, you know, I mentioned the enforcers at the O'Burney School, men who would rat on other kids and that kind of stuff. Well, a couple of them showed up at the tribunal, and one of them, a very large fellow, he sat right at the front of the hall, and he would just look at people as they came up to the mic. Well, a number of people looked at him, turned around and walked right out because they knew that he was threatening them just by being there. This man subsequently admitted that his way was paid by the United Church to fly down from Bella Bella to be there. We had issued summonses to the Prime Minister, to the Indian Affairs Minister, Jane Stewart, to the heads of all the churches, John Kishore, all the people involved in this stuff. They all got one, and none of them came, and none of them even responded by letter or anything. But they sent their native flunkies, their front men, if you like. And he and his father both admitted that the church paid their way down to basically come down and keep an eye on things and harass people. Now, I mentioned this to one of the heads of the IRAM who was running the group, that this guy was sitting there harassing people. Nothing was ever done about it. I mean, they let him do that. And then he was allowed to give his own testimony for half an hour, and even though he had threatened me and other people at the tribunal, nothing was ever done about it. you know, other tribal council elders had even threatened some of our witnesses. A guy called Harry Wilson had discovered the body of a dead girl at the Oberney School in 1967. And a couple of guys from the tribal council came up to him before he was to give his testimony and said, Harry, if you talk about that dead girl, you're going to be really sorry. And nobody's going to miss you if you're found floating face down in the water. That's what they said to him. I mean, why would native politicians not want the fact of that dead girl coming out at a tribunal when they officially support the investigation into the residential schools? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Unless you realize that these same people are themselves implicated in it in some way. And they, I think, got to some of the panel judges. I mean, that's the only thing that can describe why the information was suppressed, why they were allowed to intimidate witnesses and that kind of thing at the tribunal.
Now, what kind of other accounts came out at the tribunal? Could you talk about some of the things?
Oh, I mean, we have listed 47 different crimes that went on there at the school. I mean, everything from things like forms of torture, like needles being shoved through various parts of children's bodies if they spoke their own language, having to crawl naked down a line of other students and being beaten, and several children died as a result of this kind of thing, being deliberately exposed to tuberculosis on a regular basis, being used in various medical experiments at a place called Cooper Island, which was a Catholic school in the Gulf Islands, children who received a series of injections and several of them died as a result of it. I mean, it goes on and on, that kind of brutality. The use of electric shocks was fairly common to torture children. And, of course, the death by, I mean, here's a list right here, death by strangulation, by being thrown from windows, starvation, beatings. I mean, this kind of stuff sounds like right out of Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm. Incredible. There's seems to be a lot of similarities to what went on at the residential schools with government and military mind control operations that involve torturing children to control them and to later use them for various espionage activities, including sexual blackmail and right to assassination. What do you think the links there are?
Well, it's interesting. I think there's, by analogy, I mean, that was generally what was going on in the schools, and that they were taking this minority of enforcers and training them to do what the white culture wanted them to do. And now the same people are signing over their forest rights to multinationals, or even entering into direct agreements with multinational corporations under the so-called internal free trade agreements that, in fact, John Kishore was instrumental in helping do. I mean, there's another link there. But anyway, generally they were being used in that way, brainwashed, if you like, to forget their own culture. But I think even more directly, one of the groups of people who came to the tribunal talked about being used in a series of experiments at the Cooper Island School, where what they described as German-speaking doctors were using them not only as guinea pigs in injections, receiving various injections, but they described later that the same doctors were actually doing some very odd things with them. And we get, I mean, because of the people involved, it's kind of hard to get a clearer sense of what this is. But, I mean, for example, one man described how he was locked in a room for weeks on end. It was like a little cell. And he was brought out and given, every day, electric shocks to the head. And then they gave him, they exposed him to X-rays for a prolonged period of time. This was after he had been given what he felt was contaminated food. So what I think might have been going on there was, you know, as occurred in Auschwitz, trying out all sorts of tests on children to see what the endurance of the human body is. Children were immersed in cold water for long periods of time. That, you know, that's another thing that happened. But I think if they were looking for cures for tuberculosis and that, they were wondering if, you know, these various things would cure them. I mean, you know, it's the trouble, of course, with the testimony is that, you know, some of it sounded almost like cultic activity. It was interesting that one of the people described how Arthur Plait, who's in jail now, lived a block away from where a number of children in Victoria, B.C. have disappeared recently. This Matthew Dunahy, who disappeared a number of years ago, lived only he disappeared in a park only one block away from where Plait lived. This is before Plait was convicted and put in jail. Well, when you read about the kinds of things Plait were doing, they verge on the cultic. I mean, one child described having marks scratched on their neck on a regular basis, and being given. She says she can't remember much because of the trauma involved, but she remembers people showing up at the school and taking her away in a car somewhere and raping her and doing all sorts of funny things to her. So I think there is a real possibility that there was some kind of satanic cult or other kind of cultic activities in which a number of people were involved at a senior level. And that would explain a lot in terms of not just the cover-up, but kind of the depth of fear in people now mm-hmm. once you get into this.
Now, are you speaking of senior level of the church?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. I think it involved the church, the RCMP, the government. There was even two Indian Affairs agents who were named at the tribunal as still being active pedophiles in the West End of Vancouver. And it, you know, with the Vancouver Club ring and other activities, even provincial court judges have been named. You know, I think that this extends to fairly senior levels of the establishment in BC, which would explain a lot in terms of you know, the level of intimidation and other things that have been going on against our people.
Now, you've been mentioning the Vancouver Club, and I'd like to talk more about that. What is the Vancouver Club?
What it is?
Yes. And who are its members?
Well, you have to. It's a very elite club. You have to be invited in. It has people in it like Chief Justice Alan McEachern, the head of McMillan Bloedel, the head of the RCMP, various church lawyers who we've had dealings with. They're all members of the Vancouver Club. We had, several independent sources tell us, name the Vancouver Club all the time as a place the children are being taken to. And in fact, you know, back in 1994, a native lawyer called Renata Odger had information about the club, the Vancouver Club, and a pedophile ring that she felt was operating out of northern BC, a place called Morristown. And she had evidence that not only native leaders were bringing children down through that network, but they had photographic evidence of various Supreme Court justices who were involved in this pedophile ring. Well, when Renata Odger tried to sue these judges, not only was the case thrown out of court, but she found herself disbarred without any due process. And her own lawyer, a guy called Jack Cram, who tried to defend her, was seized in the courtroom by 10 sheriffs, drugged and hospitalized in a mental institute for a month. And Renata Odger had to flee the province, and she's living somewhere in the prairies now, kind of incommunicado because her life was threatened. I mean, all of this indicates to us that they were getting close to something. And it's the same stories that we're hearing now involving the judiciary and senior people in this province.
So she had actually witnessed a child being picked up from the streets.
She witnessed it. She had other people who witnessed it. And they apparently had a woman infiltrate the judges' circles and had photographic proof of these pedophilia activities involving the judges. Wow. Now, that's why they came down on them so severely, I think, because they had this evidence. And who knows where it is now. But, no, this stuff is very serious, and I think it indicates, it kind of confirms what independently we were learning through the Residential School Tribunal.
So, to give us an idea, how many accounts came up in the tribunal and otherwise of pedophilia going on at the Vancouver Club? And this is currently happening.
Three different sources, none of whom knew each other, none of whom had ever had any contact, and they lived in three different parts of the province, and they were all telling the same story. Mm-hmm. This was two different couples and one individual. So a total of five people who were confirming what Renata Odger had been telling us before.
And these are current accounts?
Yes.
Currently going on?
Yeah, the most recent event happened in August 1998, the most recent one that we'd be able to document. Two children were brought from the Squamish Reserve in North Vancouver to the Vancouver Club. We've learned since then that they might have moved their operations into a yacht that's operating in English Bay. And, in fact, one of the United Church lawyers who was instrumental in having me removed is probably involved in that network we've discovered.
And it seems from the other more historical accounts that this type of activity has been going on a long time within the Canadian elite.
Oh yeah, I think it's a given that this stuff went on. It's just that now there's an opening because of the residential school lawsuits and awareness that's developing about what went on here. I mean, 50,000 children dead is not something that people can push under the rug, even though they've tried to. And, it's a simple fact. Why would the United Church spend $250,000 getting rid of one minister mm-hmm. in the first public delisting of a minister in its history when they, at the same time, admitted I didn't do anything wrong? So, it just doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. And it indicates something much deeper.
Now, of the accounts that came forward in the tribunal, what time period did these accounts cover?
Of all the incidents?
As
far back as 1922 and as most recently as the Vancouver Club incidents this mm-hmm. year, but in terms of the residential schools, right up to the time they closed in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had accounts, for example, of incidents that were going on regularly in the 1970s when the schools were still open, at all the different schools that we documented in B.C.,
Now, what have you got planned for taking the results of the tribunal? What's the next step with that information?
Well, we're still approaching the United Nations through its different agencies. We're trying to get the story out into the media around the world. We've begun to get that. We had coverage in the January issue of the New Internationalist, which is a magazine out of England. They covered the tribunal and some of these atrocities. And out of that article, I've been getting contacted by different European television networks who want to follow up on this. So I think raising the international awareness of this and also from there getting people to start pressuring the different UN agencies to bring charges against the Canadian government and the churches for this genocide. I mean, that I think is the long-term aim.
And how do you feel people can help to bring about some justice with what's been going on with the residents?
Well, I always say to people, to write letters of protest to the church and that is just, it goes down the black hole. I mean, the church is in major damage control now, and their lawyers have told their people, and I know this because they've told me themselves, that they've anything to do with this issue, they're not to respond to. It's in the lawyers' hands. So that's kind of a dead end. The Justice Department, Anne McClellan, we've demanded that she launch a major investigation into these schools, which is hard for her to do because it's implicating her own government. I mean, Jean Chrétien, after all, was Indian Affairs Minister in the 70s, and he clearly knew about all this stuff from things we've learned. So, that's one of the reasons we issued the summons to him, that he never responded to. I would suggest to people, first of all, that a big letter-writing campaign begin to all the major media. And beyond that, they contact us to help get the story around and start. I believe we need more public actions on this stuff. We need to confront the church publicly with protests and petitions and just make it really hot for them, because that's the only thing that they seem to understand, and that seems to be able to bring out the truth about these things.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you aware of other groups across Canada that are interested or are trying to organize similar kind of tribunals?
Yeah. There is a tribunal happening right now in Blackfoot Territory in Montana and Alberta. And kind of inspired by what we did last year, the Blackfoot Nation they've set up a very similar tribunal with native judges, traditional judges. They're gathering the evidence, and they're going to take it to the UN, too. So I think it's a snowball. I think that that it has to come from within the native communities, but that's not to say that white people and others can't support them in that, because, in fact, they have to, because within native communities, there's instant pressure brought to bear on those elements in the leadership who are themselves implicated to keep the evidence buried. So we really have to operate in both worlds. We need the support of anybody, because it's ultimately not a native issue any more than Auschwitz is a Jewish issue. I mean, it's a human rights issue. And we have to look at it in that way, I think. Otherwise, you fall into the old trap of, let the Indians kind of handle this stuff, when that's, in fact, what's allowed this to carry on for so many decades, that kind of hiddenness on the whole issue.
Yeah, it's the silencing of people that has allowed it to carry on and perpetuate even to today.
Would you like my email or way of people getting a hold of me, or will you provide that?
Why don't you give that out now?
Well, my email is kdannett, A-N-N-E-T-T. That's small letters, K-D-A-N-N-E-T-T, at interchange.ubc.ca. And I can be reached. You can leave a message at 604-224-8782 in Vancouver.
And that was an interview with Reverend Kevin Annett, and I'd like to thank Kevin very much for talking with us on the International Connection, and also for his very brave work in exposing the abuses in the residential schools and the abuses that continue today against Native communities and particularly Native children. You've been listening to the International Connection here on CKLN 88.1. Thank you.